This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Jonathan Bennett and I join Ben Medders and Garth Vanderhoen of Meshtastic. Meshtastic is off-the-grid mesh networking. It's a new thing. It's a hot thing. It's used in all kinds of ways all over the world. You ought to be interested in this because it's really interesting stuff. I knew nothing about it before we started, and now I'm learning so much, and I all came during this show, and you should see it coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 730, recorded Wednesday, May 3rd, 2023, going off the grid with Meshtastic. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures that if a device isn't secure, it can't access your apps. It's zero trust for Okta. Visit collide.com/floss and book a demo today.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed, with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
Greetings, everyone, everywhere. I am Doc Searles. You're not, but that's a good thing. I am joined this week by Jonathan Bennett himself from Oklahoma, somewhere where he lost power last night.
Yeah, we did. It was interesting. I was sitting out here in the office with the windows open because it was nice, and all of a sudden, boom, the battery backup started beeping. I was like, oh, well, this is going to be an interesting evening. They're out there working now, so if I suddenly disappear in the middle of the show, that's maybe what happened.
No, I hope not. When it went boom, is it like a transformer exploded or something like that?
Well, that's what I figured it would be, but I kind of watched over, I went out back and watched over the fence as the guy was out there walking around, and it seems like maybe it was just an underground line shorted out because there wasn't evidence of a transformer explosion. So I don't know. I'm not a high voltage electrician though. So I'm.
All I know is that they used to be anyway, filled with PCBs, which is like this really horrible stuff that you don't want outside of a transformer. Anyway, so I'm in temporarily again for the several time in a friend's house in Los Angeles. And are you up on Meshtastic, or the topic today and our guests?
A bit. So I actually did the reach out and invited the guys here over their Discord, which I've actually found to be a great way to get a hold of devs. But no, Meshtastic. In fact, I've got a device here. The Rack Wireless makes a kit to get started, and I'm trying to remember. Somebody was asking me about how to do, and we'll get into this during the show, actually, because it's a neat story, about how to do mesh for, certain situations where maybe the cellular grid's going to get turned off. And so I started doing some looking, and I came across Meshtastic and this device, and the price was low enough. You know, there's this boundary. It's like, if I got to spend over $100 or over $200 on something, it's like, man, I just can't do that on the whim. But if it's only like $40 a piece and it sounds cool enough, I'll just go for it on a whim and hope it works out. And so this project, the hardware is just below that threshold. So I went for it, and it actually looks pretty cool for doing, meshing off grid communications, which especially in places like Oklahoma, where we have power outages and tornadoes and all kinds of fun stuff like that, every once in a while could come in handy. So that was the
you guys have earthquakes too.
We have very small earthquakes. we had back a few years ago the largest earthquake that was ever recorded in Oklahoma, and the damage was that one chimney somewhere out in the middle of nowhere fell over. And the meme was, two lawn chairs, one of them fallen over. We will rebuild. It was not a serious earthquake.
I am where, like right over there, down that hill is the Rogers Fault. In Los Angeles, where under that hillside, the strata of rock underneath there displaced 17,000 feet, and there's a there are mountains over here, up to almost 12,000 feet high. Just showed up in the geologic yesterday, so it's a little more active. So our guests today are from Meshtasset, we just said. I'll just introduce them now. We have Ben Metters. He's a full-stack C-sharp developer, does .NET, Vue.js, software engineer by day, device firmware developer on Meshtasset, among other projects at night. He's a tinkerer, does IoT, the outdoors, all kinds of stuff. And Garth Vanderhoen, he's a senior software engineer at a fintech company, not being named, in Seattle, and a lead developer on the Meshtasset iOS and Mac application. So welcome, guys. Are you both, I already know Ben's in Arkansas somewhere, and Garth, are you actually in Seattle or are you somewhere else?
Yeah, I'm in a suburb of Seattle. So,
which one?
Bellevue.
Okay, cool. Linux Journal, where I spent 24 years, was for most of its life in the Ballard district of Seattle, which I loved going to. Right. So tell us about Meshtasset and what brought you guys together. What's the big cause here?
So the history a little bit is a developer at Google named Kevin Hester. He initially found the T-Beam, which is a device that kind of has a bunch of different components all in one package. So it's got a Tesla battery and a GPS chip and the microcontroller and an OLED screen all in one device with the ESP32. Yeah, Ben's holding one up there. And when that came out, that was kind of a neat, where you didn't have to cobble together four or five sensors to have a kind of complete handheld device. And his use case originally was paragliding and hiking, I believe. And for a long time, for a year, he wrote the firmware, the Android app, and a Python application, and kind of released them, and people tested and created some new features and stuff. And Ben and I got involved after a little less than a year after the project started. And Kevin had some back issues that prevent him from being able to code super effectively for long periods of time. So he's able to retire pretty happily, but he's not able to code much anymore. So a lot of what Ben and I worked on in the first year was just kind of figuring out how to replace a initial benevolent dictator of an open source project and kind of spread what one person was doing in three different apps into a bunch of, we now have a web application. I wrote the iOS Apple apps. We have students at Dartmouth that are working on a Rust application for search and rescue. So there's a whole bunch of different clients. We have our Android developers in Brazil. We have firmware developers in Germany. So that's kind of our recent story, has been replacing a really impressive developer that was kind of doing everything. And now we have kind of a host of us doing little pieces at a time. So,
Ben, I want to ask you if the back issues had to do with paragliding. Did I hear that right?
I'm not entirely sure the nature of where his back issue started, but I know a lot of it was exacerbated by sitting in a chair right all day and banging away at code. So
was it your back issues?
It was Kevin.
I see. Okay. I was wondering where you go paragliding in Arkansas, but
not very far.
Ben, why don't you take it from there and tell us kind of what part of the project you do, and if there's any, I don't know, sort of pitfalls about taking over from a benevolent dictator, because that strikes me as something that a lot of projects are going to have to do at some point or another. So I'm curious more about that, but also, Ben, kind of what your hand is in the project.
Yeah, so I kind of took on the role, I guess it was August of last year, as project lead for the firmware. So I started working on my own little tweaks to the firmware, like Garth mentioned, back in the first year that after Kevin had released it. And as you're kind of more involved in the community, you know, people start to take notice and like, hey, you're contributing a lot. You want some increased responsibility here. And so
here, let me give you admin on Discord so that you can help moderate. Here, let me give you a push ability on GitHub. Yes, I'm familiar with this.
Yeah. So it kind of organically grew out of that. And, you know, as Garth mentioned, you know, Kevin was a brilliant developer on the project, being able to sort of simultaneously ship device firmware and the Android app and the Python client. You know, he was very much one of these rare 10x developers that people like to say. But so it's been interesting kind of democratizing the efforts. You know, we've gotten such a big community of volunteers now that work on their own little slice. And then, you know, even past that, I would say there's a lot of community efforts that aren't necessarily a part of Meshtastic itself, but build on top of Meshtastic.
All right, so let's take a step back then, and I've got to ask, what is Meshtastic? I know, sort of we've touched on this, but give us the overview, the 30,000 foot view. What problem exactly is this trying to solve, and what can people do with it today?
So our sort of project tagline is we're an open source, off grid, decentralized mesh network built to run on affordable devices that are low power. So, essentially the, you know, Kevin's sort of, initial use case of paragliding was, you know, there's no, once you get to a certain point, you run out of cell infrastructure. So having, low power IoT devices that you can pair via, Bluetooth, to your cell phone apps and in the initial case, Android, and be able to send text messages and location information. That's kind of the core of what Meshtastic is. And in terms of how it does that, it's utilizing, as Garth mentioned, you know, these T-Beam devices were sort of the first, you know, pilot devices. And they have a LoRa modem. And for those that are not familiar with LoRa technology, it's a radio protocol that essentially can operate on license-free bands, and it uses spread spectrum technology, and it offers a ton of range at low bandwidth operation and low power operation. So that's kind of the core of what Meshtastic does and how it operates.
And so what kinds of data are we pushing using Meshtastic? Is this TCP/IP stack, location data? Now, can we do voice calls over it? What's the landscape look like there?
Most of the messages that you would send with Meshtastic is kind of the core use case of it is text messages, very short text messages, like you would imagine SMS, position location information. So you can send, you know, for the devices that have GPS or can acquire a location from your apps, they can send, their position over the mesh. Recently we added, what we call waypoints. So that's sending an ad hoc message where we're saying, I'm going to drop a pin over here and, you know, have an icon and a name. So you can kind of share that sort of thing. There's also, telemetry. So one of the things that I worked on initially getting involved in the project was augmenting a lot of our supported sensors and getting things like temperature and barometric pressure, you know, any kind of sort of weather station type data pushed over the mesh. So the main limitation with the LoRa protocol is, you know, you're dealing with such a small bandwidth, so you have to kind of really optimize things for the wire, and you're limited on what you can send over that. There's not much room for things like video or voice or porting a full TCP IP stack to over LoRa, but yeah.
You mentioned range. LoRa is really an interesting topic in itself. But what kind of, I mean, so I'm just going through my head to so many scenarios. I'm an old radio guy, but I mean, by old, I mean like tube period stuff. And, but I'm wondering, you know, so I'm thinking there's in communities, but shouldn't these also like belong in every car now? Almost. I'm going that far with it. Like, this is an ideal thing to just have, I would imagine. But do you have to have a community involvement? Like, you have to know everybody else has got one. There's like four questions at once there. But,
yeah. So I would say partially we haven't figured out a great global mesh solution. There's a lot of radio configuration options and details in order to mesh properly. So basically we have a set of settings, and then everybody that shares those same settings could potentially either contribute to each other's mesh network. So they would each have different secrets that they're using, but they're using the same settings. And then those packets can be shared amongst different people chatting distinctly. And then there are some limits to the total number of nodes that could be in any one network. So we have had a lot of community interest in building kind of larger global networks. And we have some instances now where we're getting towards the limits that are set in the firmware. They're small microcontrollers, right? So we have an in-memory limitation at this point. There's kind of a rolling 80 device limit. So as your device has seen 80 devices, if it sees another one, it'll drop out the last one it saw and add a new one.
It's like a network switch, only being able to store so many MAC addresses.
Totally is. We have a structure within each device. We call it the Node DB, right? So because it is operating on a mesh network, there is an essence of you having to keep track of known nodes, what their names are, MAC addresses, et cetera. And that scales only to a certain point. And the other sort of limitation is because it is a mesh network that is operating on a very low bandwidth space, rebroadcasting sort of falls apart past a certain point. As you scale up the number of nodes, those messages getting rebroadcasted with 80 nodes that may or may not see each other at the time, that utilizes a lot of airtime. So it would be nice to have more support than 80 nodes, but it really does get pretty complex fairly quickly.
So I know something else Doc was curious about, and he would ask this if I gave him the chance, I'm sure. But what is the range? Like, how far have you seen these connections work?
Personally, my limit, which I'm being in sort of the hilly Arkansas terrain here, there's not really great line of sight like you might get out west. I've been able to get around 50 miles, and that was line of sight. Our world record meshtastic distance point to point was a guy in New Zealand got 166 kilometers, and that was just dipole antennas and two T-beam devices. Nothing special going on there, no amplification or anything.
But not that little stubby antenna, right? You've got the little tiny stubby antenna on that TV. That thing's not going 160.
It was more like this. So most of the devices within the US are operating on the 900 megahertz ISM band. So a dipole isn't very big in that case. But I would say one of the first things that if folks want to achieve really good range is throw away the stock antennas. And I think that's probably true of a lot of different radio applications, right? The first thing you upgrade is the antenna. We've tried our best in our community. And if you get in our Discord, you'll find a lot of antenna recommendations where folks have really done the their due diligence to try to locate well-tuned antennas for your LoRa band.
Yeah, I know with my little tiny setup here, you know, this is, I think this is the LoRa antenna on this one, and it's not great. Yep. I can get about a block and a half down the road before they stop talking to each other. So one of these days I will show back up in your Discord and start picking brains about better antenna and antenna placement and all of that. It kind of seems to me, and I guess this is maybe just my use case thinking about it, but you're not going to see probably a lot of community-wide installs. This is going to be more, you know, one person wants to track their vehicles, or one family wants to be able to have contact, or a group of hikers want to be able to talk to each other. And so most of your rollouts is probably, what, 4 or 5 nodes at the max?
It gets used. So there's a lot of people with off-grid properties where they have a section of land that has a hard time getting a cell signal, or they have a cell signal at one part of their property and they don't for the rest of the farm. One of the developers that did some of the initial iOS map work is a farmer in New Zealand. And so he was tracking his quads around the farm, and had 10 or 15 nodes tracking his family and workers and things, managing all the different things that were going on the farms. It's been used for some races, like long races in like Arizona or desert places. So kind of anywhere where you don't have great cell coverage, it helps to have some height. So, you know, like Burning Man has been a use case people have tried, but it's so flat that the success has been less good potentially than paragliding or hiking, where you have some nodes with a height advantage that can communicate to the other parts of the mesh.
We just need to mount an antenna on top of whatever sculpture they put out there. Just get it high enough.
Yeah, the car is a really good use case because you get a magnetic antenna and put it on the top of your car, get a big ground plane, and get a pretty good signal in an automobile to back to a location. I kind of live at I live where there are other radio towers within blocks of me. Mm-hmm. And so even though I'm in an urban area, I could pretty easily get 5 or 6 miles because I have some height advantages. I actually got all the way from Bellevue to Seattle across the lake, which was about 12 miles. And does not look like it's really line of sight, but, it's kind of line of sight once you take out all the trees and buildings. And the LoRa technology, which is what's used in a lot of your water meters and gas meters and those various smart utility items, is pretty good at getting through. So
I'm wondering if the system uses something similar to what happens with cellular telephony, which is in some ways in similar frequencies that are up there. Well, I mean, your phone laying on the seat of your car is not in the line of sight generally of a cell tower or a cell site. A lot of them aren't towers at all. They're just like on the side of a building or something. But part of it is that the cellular system makes use of what used to be a problem with TV and FM radio, which is multipath, where you get interference. What happens is the signal is carried. In other words, the throughput goes on multiple channels, as it were, multiple paths. So you don't always have line of sight, but you have a kind of efficiency built in. And the receivers with cellular anyway are much more sensitive than AM and FM radios ever were, because it uses digital technology. Is something similar going on? Is that built into LoRaN? Or I'm in an area where I don't know much. I know too much of the old stuff and not enough of the new stuff, but I'm just wondering about how the signal processing works to take advantage of when there isn't line of sight, or where, you know, the signal might degrade a bit, but you can still make sense of it.
It degrades pretty quickly, I would say, outside of line of sight once you get past certain distance thresholds. And it definitely happens when you're in an urban environment, where you have a lot of buildings, right? And you've got, physical structures. Of course, LoRa hates going through the earth more than anything. So yeah, if you've got a large hill there, But I can't necessarily speak to its similarities with cell technology, but I know when Semtech initially developed LoRa, they were sort of competing with a lot of the existing 900 megahertz solutions. So part of the protocol was sort of being designed to cut through like GSM interference.
So I'm really curious, do we have store and forward technology here, or is it just blast once and hope everybody hears it?
So we do have a store and forward module that is kind of working. It's been worked on off and off. store and forward does, I will say, work with an asterisk, but it is not enabled by default. So the traditional mode is just attempt to rebroadcast the messages. And we do that several times if we don't hear an acknowledgement. So the traditional mode within the mesh is to do, I would call it a modified naive rebroadcasting or flood rebroadcasting, because we are rebroadcasting essentially like regardless of whether or not a node heard us, just in the attempts to, you know, there might be more nodes out there that didn't hear this other node's rebroadcast. And there's also acknowledgments that take place for each message to ensure that that message was delivered, and whether or not to give the phone a notification that we did not successfully deliver that to any other nodes.
Okay. And that was one of the other things I was going to ask about, is in the different rooms that someone has set up, whether there's acknowledgement that, hey, this other node has heard this message. You know, you think about times when you're doing human to human communication. So missing a single temperature reading, it's not the end of the world. But if you've tried to send a text message to someone over Meshtastic, and potentially if that's an important message, like, I need help, here's where I'm at, it would be really nice to know for sure that the person on the other end has seen it.
Yeah, in our protocol, we have kind of an established, we call it packet priority, right? So some messages need to be acknowledged, like you said, and others don't, can kind of be sent in the background. It's like fire and forget, you know, hopefully somebody heard this. And those still get rebroadcasted. So they're still a part of the mesh. That there's just not the additional overhead of acknowledgments, because, you know, acknowledgments are airtime too. So. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, I want to get Garth in on this conversation some, and we haven't asked him a whole lot, but I see that he does the iOS work. And I'm curious, Garth, did you pretty much do the iOS bring up? Because this was originally an Android. It was started by somebody at Google, so it was on Android originally. Imagine that. Was iOS kind of your baby?
Yeah, so that was, I'm a .NET developer for work, and found that to be sort of unpleasant for open source. So all of the open source stuff that I have done that was popular, whatever, was Raspberry Pi or Ansible scripts, things like that. And so I, for a while, was carrying around an Android phone with my iPhone to make this work while I was hiking and stuff, and just got tired of carrying around the Android phone. So I bought a Mac Mini and learned Swift UI, and the improvements of Swift UI have mapped pretty nicely with working on getting the app figured out. We had some initial, because it was developed only with Android, there were some differences between the Bluetooth stacks and what Apple required that took a while to sort out. So I worked with Ben a lot on that. And then in November, when we launched version 2 of the firmware, then I launched the app in the App Store. It'd been on test flight, and we had been working through various bugs and stuff before that. So, yeah, I was tired of carrying two phones mostly.
Now, that raises another question. Are there any of these devices that are, you know, on the Meshtastic network that are standalone? And I want to say I've seen an image of, you know, kind of a PCB with the little tactile key buttons on it and an antenna coming off. And I'm trying to remember if that was a Meshtastic specific device or not. Does something like that exist?
Yes, that's it's called the Messenger. So our mesh with the M-E-S-H.
Clever.
And that is a fully standalone device. It uses an I2C keyboard and the OLED screen. And then the developer of the mesh or the Messenger device worked with a firmware developer in Germany to set up some additional notifications. So he's got like an LED light and a Vibra motor and stuff in the device so that the a light will show up until you dismiss it, showing that there's new messages received. And then we're also working on enhancing the on-screen display of your message history and some of that stuff, which is not totally complete. Right now you can kind of see a message when it comes in and you can type your own message, but there's the device picture. I see it scrolling by there. So, and then we also support using just a rotary encoder to do like canned messages. So if you've used like a Garmin inReach where you can have, I think they have like 3 preset messages that you can edit in the cloud and then 5 or 6 built in. I'm headed home, send an emergency, whatever. Mm-hmm. Type of stuff, and you can use a rotary encoder to dial through. Yeah, Ben's got one there. To twist That's through cool. the set messages and send that. So having some standalone devices is definitely a use case that people have. You can get a lot longer battery life. So these devices that are based off the NRF52, which is what's in that rack that you have there. That's really a long life, low power device with a that can last for weeks at a time on a single battery charge. So emergencies or backpacking or places where you don't have much power, that's a great way to go.
So that we've queuing up questions in the background here. But first I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Collide. That's Collide with a K. Collide is a device trust solution that ensures unsecured devices can't access your apps. Collide has some big news. If you're an Okta user, Collide can get your entire fleet up to 100% compliance. Collide patches one of the major holes in zero trust architecture. It's device compliance. Think about it. Your identity provider only lets known devices log into apps, but just because a device is known doesn't mean it's in a secure state. In fact, plenty of the devices in your fleet probably shouldn't be trusted. Maybe they're running an out-of-date OS version, or maybe they've got unencrypted credentials lying around. If a device isn't compliant or isn't running the Collide agent, it can't access the organization's SaaS apps or other resources. The device user can't log into your company's cloud apps until they fix the problem on their end. It's that simple. For example, a device will be blocked if an employee doesn't have an up-to-date browser. Using end-user remediation helps drive your fleet to 100% compliance without overwhelming your IT team. Without Collide, IT teams have no way to solve these compliance issues or to stop insecure devices from logging in. With Collide, you can set and enforce compliance across your entire fleet, Mac, Windows, and Linux. Collide is unique in that it makes device compliance part of the authentication process. When a user logs in with Okta, Collide alerts them to compliance issues and prevents unsecured devices from logging in. It's security you can feel good about because Collide puts transparency and respect for users at the center of their product. To sum it up, Collide's method means fewer support tickets, less frustration, and most importantly, 100% fleet compliance. Visit collide.com/floss to learn more or book a demo. That's collide.com/floss. So guys, I'm sitting here as we're talking and imagining all kinds of possible uses. And the word community is kind of very broad, but one of them that just jumps into my mind is military. Is there a military use that you know of? I suppose being open source, they could just kind of roll their own and you never learn about it. But is there a military profile here?
So one of the sort of the community efforts is to integrate with the ATAC application that was recently opened up by the U.S. Department of Defense, and it runs on Android phones. And so one of our community members developed what a plugin that's called the ATAC Forwarder. And the ATAC platform is essentially like a, it's like a big Blue Force tracking sort of application that has a ton of different bells and whistles that most people will never use. But one of the main use cases is just tracking folks, sending messages out to teams and units within a team. And so somebody, you know, found that Meshtastic would be a pretty good transport layer for making sort of an infrastructureless TAC ecosystem. And so that's kind of where the ATAC Forwarder plugin came into play. And I would say even outside of the ATAC ecosystem, yeah, it totally makes sense as a use case for tracking folks on some kind of military operation. Certainly like search and rescue is kind of a big one, because you know, you think about the conditions and being outside of cell service completely in search and rescue and some of those remote locations. Something like Meshtastic completely fits that profile of being able to keep up communications, particularly location information, to be able to track folks as they're setting up grid squares.
It's funny. So I'm trying to figure out how to spell ATAC. Jonathan just said something, ATAK, and it wants to correct that. the browser wants to make it something else. So what is the correct spelling there? Just
ATAK. Yeah, I think so. I think there's multiple versions of ATAC, and I think there it is, ATAC Forwarder. But one of them was sort of opened up to the public as, and they call it like Android Tactical Awareness Kit, I think is what it stands for. And it's, you know, the government kind of opened this up to be utilized by, you know, first responders, search and rescue groups, those sorts of applications, because they recognized that it was a powerful tool to be, you know, used by more than just military applications.
I mean, generally what happens with a technology like this, that has potentially endless broad applications, a few single kinds of use, like we just mentioned, the military or search and rescue, show up. But I'm wondering, I mean, if you did a pie chart of all the different uses right now that are going on with Meshtastic and LoRa for that matter as well, what does that look like? What's the biggest way, or is it just all of the slices are so small it's pretty hard to generalize?
So I think there's probably like a third of the usage is sort of hiking and outdoors stuff of some kind. Then the military search and rescue / people playing airsoft, which is all kind of a similar batch of things using TAC server, is probably 10-20%. And then there's just all sorts of other use cases where there are communities that, you know, where cell service is hard for whatever reason, is kind of the rest of the use cases. People use, like you mentioned, LoRaWAN earlier, which is kind of, we use LoRa, but LoRaWAN is a separate, very organized set of data that is used mostly for like agriculture sensors and the water meters and stuff. And we use the P2P LoRa, which is kind of like just device to device. So we're not doing these massive sensor groups, but rather these smaller batches of devices that can work together. So I wouldn't say that there's a single use case that's been way more than all the others. The outdoor use case is definitely the main one. Emergency preparedness. Canada had their main cell provider go down. and we had an increase in Canadian users interested in a way to communicate if once again the cell provider went down for a week, right? And so then, so that also people come up with a use case as they are affected by something. You know, we had people in Iowa that were affected by, it was called a derecha, some sort of land hurricane. Didn't sound very fun. But they, there was a community there that worked to set up a network so that they had a, you know, a node on a taller building, and they had some way to communicate where to go charge your cell phones and things, because they'd had a year earlier an emergency that they kind of hadn't had good communications for. So kind of a way to fix problems in cell connectivity, you know, lower cost, small sensor networks. So, you know, you might build a LoRaWAN's a great way to build a 1,000 sensor network if you have that many. But if you have a much smaller network, that can be cost prohibitive, where you could build up a bunch of individual community nodes for air quality or temperature, that kind of thing. So a lot of different use cases. And a lot of what we've done over the last year is try to get ready to accept more of these use cases, because the firmware spends a lot of time managing the mesh. And so we've created some serial modules and things that allow people to hook their own devices and sensors and stuff into the mesh and start using it for whatever ideas they come up with for their own sensor networks or a piece of data they want to get from a long way away to where they're at. So
I want to ask about something, and there's a term here that I think may be a little overloaded, and that is modules. When we're talking about modules, are we talking about hardware or little blocks of software?
In this case, it would be little blocks of software, but there are hardware modules as well, right? Within some of the some of like the rack wireless options, like you installed the it looked like you had the GPS module on your rack wireless device. But we have sort of a module architecture in terms of the firmware, where bits of code are sort of plugged into the pipeline to interact with devices or peripherals. So we've got, like, as Garth mentioned, the serial module. So that gives the user a the ability to send stuff over the mesh or receive stuff through the mesh with a UART interface. And there's also, you know, the telemetry module, as I mentioned earlier, is for interacting with sensors that you might install over the I2C bus of a device. Canned messages module is another popular one. That's the one that enables the messenger device to be able to free type and scroll through your list of we call them canned messages that you can pre-program your device to have as a standalone unit and fire off over the mesh as a text.
Yeah, so that's interesting. As you were talking about some of the use cases, I was thinking very much about last night. I think we mentioned this at the very top of the show, but the power here went off for about 4 hours last night, and we've done a few things. Obviously, we're kind of in flyover country, and so we get tornadoes here, and we've done a few things to try to be prepped for that. And one of the things that was just great to have was this little cheap candle lantern. They're like $20, and they make these 9-hour candles. And when the power went off, I just went and lit that and was able to hang it up in the middle of a room, and we had just enough light to see. And, you know, you go through something like that, and it's kind of a great test for, are you prepared enough for when the power goes out? What have you done that's going to work well? What have you done that's not going to work very well? I'm kind of thinking about that with Meshtastic here, because like you say, every once in a while, the cell phones do stop working for whatever reason. Whether it's because of a weather event or a bug, you know, somebody tripped over the cable in the data center. And it really seems to me that there's going to be, and maybe there already has been, but there's going to be some disaster of some sort, and there's going to be somebody that has a Meshtastic node grid already set up and ready to go and really going to be able to be the heroes because of it. Has that happened yet, or have you guys been just responding when things happen?
You know, I'll kind of take this one because, and you might remember this, JB, because you're not too far from my neck of the woods in Arkansas, but we had an EF3 tornado that rolled through Little Rock recently, and it actually knocked down a cell tower. And, you know, that tended to degrade performance with folks' mobile data operations in that part of town. It wasn't bad enough to need Meshtastic yet, but it certainly got me kind of mobilized to, man, I really need to get this thing, you know, set up to where we can have emergency communications, because it's frustrating to not have, your cell phone working and be able to get into contact with people and know where folks are. And two-way radios only work so well. And not everybody is an amateur radio enthusiast. So this, you know, I see a really good space for Meshtastic in kind of prepared emergency preparedness for folks that do live in areas that are prone to disasters like this.
Yeah. We actually have a question from the chat room that's really interesting, and I want to get this in. It's from Gumby in our IRC chat room. He says, don't you run afoul of FCC regulations if you start homebrewing antenna plus radio configurations?
You can, is the short answer. If you exceed the, the FCC, and I can't remember if it's part 90, it's one of those FCC part numbers that, where they regulate, the ISM band. So your 900 megahertz, your 2.4 gigahertz. And I think 5.8, right? There are limitations. We do our best in the firmware to, part of the reason why we have what we call LoRa regions is to do our due diligence to make sure that people don't violate their particular country's ISM band limitations. Mm-hmm. The only way that you can unlock and sort of get the radio god mode, keys to the kingdom, where you can start modifying your transmit power, is through licensed operation. We call it ham mode, where you can define your frequency, override duty cycles, set your transmit power to above what your country might allow with ISM band usage. Here in the U.S., that 900 megahertz would fall under the 33 centimeter band, if I'm not mistaken, in ham. And you get a just ludicrous amount of transmit power from the FCC. They give you like 1500 watts or something. I can't remember the specific figure. I haven't seen a 1500 watt Meshtastic device. If somebody wants to do a moon bounce, that's that's on the table.
Yeah, that's great. So, but when you go ham mode, though, there's this little quirk with amateur radio in the United States. And this is kind of a pet peeve of mine. I am amateur licensed, but one of the reasons that I don't use it very much is because there's a restriction that you cannot use encryption. And there are some differences of understanding of exactly what this means. But it's real dicey to use encryption with amateur radio license. And that probably means that you have to run everything in the clear with Meshtastic once you go ham mode, doesn't it?
That's correct. So we drop encryption, and that's something I failed to mention earlier, is that when you start at your mesh in Meshtastic, by default, since we are on the ISM band and you can run encryption, we actually run AES-256 bit encrypted payloads by default. So there's a fair bit of privacy that you get out of the box. But when you enable licensed operations, we drop the encryption from the payload. So they're transmitted in clear text. They're still encoded in the Meshtastic scheme, but they're not encrypted. So anybody else on that frequency would be able to see those payloads. We also, transmit what we call the node info, which is sort of the announcement of like, this is, this is a node on the mesh. You know, here's my ID, here's my name, everything. We actually set that to your call sign, your ham radio call sign, and transmit that every 10 minutes in order to be compliant with the regulation. So we've worked hard to try to really, really be as legal as possible. Now, as you know, somebody can set up a crazy Yagi antenna and an amplifier, and of course, mm-hmm. you know, violate the heck out of the FCC, but that's, I can't control that.
Well, that's kind of dangerous, because there are hams out there who their goal in life, their hobby is finding people that do stuff like that. And it's not real hard to figure out where radio signals are coming from, actually. It's a whole game of let's find the transmitter that's breaking the rules. All right. I do want to ask, one of the other modules that I've seen that I've heard a little something about is apparently there is an audio module. And this kind of blows my mind, because I know the hardware that you guys are running on. What's the story with the audio module?
One of our German firmware developers actually pioneered that, and I have not. I confess I haven't played with it yet, but that operates on the 2.4 gigahertz only LoRa modems, because those offer more bandwidth. And the way that that one operates is it uses very highly compressed codec 2 algorithm encoded audio. So some ham radio guys might be familiar with that. There's a ham radio protocol that's kind of been developed over the past few years, called M17 project, that utilizes that as well. And it's supposedly like one of the best voice compression codecs. So, you know, because LoRa is so low bandwidth, even on the higher bandwidth 2.4 gigahertz spectrum modems, we're really trying to cram as much as we can. So you're getting essentially a short voice message that's encoded and then reassembled on the other side. But it's that one's still very fresh. So you're kind of, you know, here there be dragons. So you're on your own playing with that particular one, but it's really exciting.
Yeah, it sounds pretty interesting, and I could see some future there. Okay, one of the last questions, we're getting towards the bottom of our time. One of the last questions I want to ask, though, is, and I ask this because I don't see it in the documentation anywhere, what is the recommended way to get started with Meshtastic? Like, what is the beginner-friendly hardware to go out and buy?
So there's a bunch of assorted devices that people, community members and such, are selling on Etsy that are completed. I'd say for a handset, anything that has the NR-F52 is a good choice, because it has the best battery life. The T-Beam is, if you just want to get two devices and pop batteries in them and go out and start doing some range testing, which is, I think, probably the best way to start, right, is to get two things and see how it works in some locations where you have communications issues to solve, right? And those devices are useful, and then you can make all sorts of different radios, right, to do different use cases, or to be a repeater that sits on a hill and has a bigger antenna and, you know, is kind of the central hub of your network. So it depends on your use case a little bit. But I think getting a couple of devices and just doing a little phone-to-phone testing to see how things work is probably the best way to get started. The LoRa technology is pretty good. So I know when I started, I, like a lot of these things, sat down, ordered myself like 7 or 8 different devices, and found for the like 2 by 5 mile area I was trying to cover that I really needed like 3 devices. So, you know, get a couple and test out how it actually works in the areas where you'll be using it.
All right. Very cool. And then I've got to ask before we let you go, what is the weirdest or most unusual, most creative use case that you've seen somebody use Meshtastic for? Either of you can take it. Whoever has a good story.
So we're seeing more music festival stuff, which has been interesting because the hardware devices are then adding features that are kind of new, like LEDs flashing and stuff to be a part of, you know, it's kind of a combination device communication where there's bad cell service. And then also being a light for the electronic music festival and some of that. So that's been kind of interesting. And then, a couple of our bigger networks are in Ukraine. So, that's been kind of an interesting, use case. And we've had a lot of growth in Europe, I think, because of, you know, being a war in Europe for the first time in a long time has created some of those same, off-grid and emergency preparedness and stuff, types of use cases in the last couple years. So.
I'm curious because I have family members who climb. Do you have people climbing mountains that use it? Is that just more gear that you just don't want because you want to travel light? I have no idea.
You know, the satellite stuff is pretty good at this point. So if you're a mountaineer, yeah. I think you probably have a Garmin InReach device or you're using the iPhone satellite connected piece, you know, for that. You're not taking any chances. A lot of people hiking, you know, not at 8,000 feet and above are probably where most of our uses are at this point.
Yeah, it's so you're talking about it. Is the geographic distribution of use, is it concentrated in Europe or is it just sort of like began in Europe and is spread elsewhere? You mentioned New Zealand was and farmers there. I'm sort of thinking about how communities form and what they're about still.
So New Zealand is obviously a bunch of little islands and water. So they have kind of the perfect LoRa line of sight, right? The record is set from the top of the mountain to a boat. And so like, there's no better radio signal than the top of a mountain to a boat you could see over water. So the US is probably 75%, and then the rest of the world is probably 25, with 20% of that being Europe and half of that being probably Germany. It's very popular in Germany for whatever reason. We have one of our main firmware developers is there, so I know he has done some promotion. We've been featured there some. So in the last year, we've had a lot of European growth.
Yeah. So if somebody listening to this for the first time, not knowing anything about us, did you go first to the Meshtastic site or go to your GitHub or both? Or what's the best way to jump in?
I would say the website's a good place to start, but I would encourage people to go straight into the Discord as well, because there's so much involvement in that Discord. It's very, very helpful people there, and just a lot of involvement with the community in general. I think that's one of the things that's kind of pushed the project forward more than anything, is just getting folks in there where they can have conversations.
And I'm thinking too, because we had some people from the ham world on recently, Levi Maya from Santa Barbara in particular. What's the appeal to the hams that are out there? Because I know we have some that are listening here. Just like, add this to your portfolio of gear that you can work with, or I'm looking for what the van is between the hams and you guys.
Yeah, I would say it, you know, a good way to think of Meshtastic is kind of a more modern extensible version of what APRS is. You know, you've obviously got the location component, you've got text with your ham, you know, radio license, you've got a lot of power at your disposal on the 70 centimeter band or the 33 centimeter band. And LoRa is just a resilient signal. So if you can put a Meshtastic node on a ham tower and amplify it, I'm pretty convinced you'll get some exceptional range that might even eclipse, you know, a traditional APRS station.
I know a bunch of guys that like to, you know, their goal in life is to put repeaters on mountains. you know, and especially here in Southern California, where you can walk to the top of a lot of them. And I don't know, I guess if you're running some off of solar with a battery, that would be kind of cool. Yeah, because you're not sucking a lot of power off the grid. There are more questions queued up, but we're pretty much at the end of the show. So we always end with the questions we ask ask our guests. What are your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Oh, I'm gonna upset people and say VS Code. It's gotten so good. Okay, VS Codeium, fine. No.
That's better.
I remember, I'm a .NET developer by day, so
yeah.
And scripting language, PowerShell. No, not PowerShell.
That's another one.
I would say probably, you know, JavaScript, TypeScript, just because I have so much of a experience with it. But I've done Python and Ruby and all the. I like strongly typed languages. I like TypeScript, C Sharp.
Yeah, I really don't use a single IDE anymore because it seems like, especially during, well, I don't have much choice. I have to use Xcode for the Apple stuff, which works pretty well, and I have to use VS Code. It works some. I've done, I don't know, probably mostly Python and Bash for scripting stuff, and then whatever cloud things need.
Well, this has been great, guys. I'm looking forward to finding out how well people are responding to this, because I think it's a really extremely interesting territory at the leading edge of open source development. So great having you guys on.
Thanks for having us. It was fun.
Yeah, great to be here.
So, Jonathan, that was good.
Good stuff, yeah.
And you've got one. That's cool.
I do. I have two already of them, actually. And like I said, I have one sitting at my desk, and I put one hanging off my cell phone and went driving down the street and discovered very quickly that I did not have nearly enough range for it to be particularly useful. So one of my to-do list items is figuring out what I need to do as far as getting a bigger antenna that, you know, ideally I can hoist one up on top of the house, maybe put a magnetic based one on each of the cars, and then hang a couple off of cell phones, have a little five device mesh that I can go a little bit further out with and be able to report location and all of that stuff. Cause I think that could be useful in some particular situations, but it's just cool. It's a neat project. And, you know, it's cool to see guys out there working on something like this and people picking it up and using it. And I'm really interested to see kind of what comes next for them as they continue working on things, maybe work out some of those problems, or I say problems, challenges with doing store and forward and bigger meshes, and just some of the things that you look at and you think, man, it could be really useful if you could work some of these out and then get more people on board with it. I think it'd be neat.
It's funny when my wife took a look at the internet for the first time in 1995, when it came into our house. And everybody's talking about this, the World Wide Web. And she said, the sweet spot of this thing is local. And then just the other day, she said the same thing, a similar thing about AI, because AI is like eating the world right now. She said, the sweet spot there is actually personal. It's not corporate. And, you know, I want one for my house. And I sense with this, that this is really the very beginning of something that can, something's going to take off in a big way where it becomes a household word. That's the thought that I have. I don't know if it happens or not, but I think there's a real potential there.
Yeah. And there are some other things similar to this, and we should have asked them about, and we didn't. I believe it's called the Helium Network, is actually LoRa plus blockchain. And so if we have them back again, we definitely need to get their thoughts on that and how that works with Meshtastic, if there's any kind of Venn diagram crossover there.
I was thinking, you could weigh down anything with blockchain. There's a pull quote for you. That is
true. You can take any good idea and ruin it by it.
Right, just, yeah, put that on the, put your family on the blockchain. You know? It was great. So what do you have to plug this week?
Oh, sure. So my main thing, of course, is over at Hackaday. I do the security column every Friday. It goes live Friday morning. I have a lot of fun there covering the things going on in the news. And then I do the occasional other odd story. I don't remember if I've written Meshtastic up for Hackaday yet or not, but if I haven't, I'm sure I will at some point. And then there's some other things that we go on there. And then the other thing to mention is the Untitled Linux Show, which is a lot of fun. We go live with that on Saturday afternoons. And that is a Club Twit exclusive show. So we record it over on Discord. Got to be a member of Club Twit to get a hold of it. Of course, ad free. And if you're not on Club Twit, it's only $7 a month and you get ad free access to all of the shows. Why aren't you on Club Twit? but anyway, we really have a lot of fun with the Untitled Linux Show, keeping track with Linux development and applications, some how to's, lots of fun there. And, you know, we'd love to see folks join us.
That's great. I'm looking at the back channel here. Anyway, so, all right, this has been great. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, everybody. Next week, and I have to bring the thing up again. I'm always not quite ready. And this week, I made sure I was ready. And now I can't find where the thing is on my thing. Oh, gosh. All right. Scroll down. Oh. And next week. Oh, I can't make the spreadsheet work.
So next week,
you do it, Jonathan.
Sure. So next week, we've got Dan Middleton of the Confidential Computing Consortium. And then we do want to let folks know we're going to be running about an hour and a half early next week because we're preempted by a Google event that Twit is going to cover. So come whatever an hour and a half early happens to be in your particular time zone. Here in Central Time, it's going to be about 10 o'clock in the morning, I think. So that's 8 a.m. Twit time.
Yeah,
on the East
Coast. And for me too. I'm on the West Coast right now. It's going to be 8 a.m.
Well, yeah. That's sure to be fun.
yeah. So, but that's great. Thanks for catching me on that. I was so prepared I couldn't do it. That there it goes. And what can I say? All right. Thanks, everybody. We will see you next week.
You're welcome.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of AdAster Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.